most dramatic and stirring scenes in history, and certainly one of the most encouraging ones in the Bible itself. The chief enemy of Nehemiah and his efforts to rebuild Jerusalem, the city of David, was a petty despot ruler named Sanballat. And this Sanballat was a Moabite who was in league with Tobiah the Ammonite, who was a slave, and Geshem the Arabian. This Sanballat was a descendant of Lot. He was the governor of Samaria under Darius. He was related to the high priest of Israel because of the mixed marriages that the Israelites had entered into in defiance of God's word. Tobiah was also related to the Jews through Lot and by marriage, even more directly than Sanballat. And Geshem was a sheikh who probably settled in the region after the Jews were carried out because of their sin. We're told that when this governor, Sanballat, heard that Jerusalem was being resurrected, that he was furious, very indignant, and mocked the Jews. That is, the news ignited a firestorm of anger in this man. And that anger so troubled him that it couldn't be contained. And so he voiced that anger in stammering, spitting expressions of ridicule and hatred towards Nehemiah and Jerusalem. John Trapp says, by word and gesture, fleering, it's a term we don't use anymore, good old 17th century word, fleering, that means sneering laughter. And jeering, flouting, and scoffing, he spat out against what Nehemiah was doing. So you see there in the first two verses, but it so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned? You notice here that Sanballat calls Nehemiah and his people feeble. That is, they're sickly and weak and really unable to do anything. He mocks their attempts to exercise any sort of freedom or independency. What do they think they're doing? What in the world are they up to? They think they can just come in here and do this freely? He scorns their religious activities, and he questions their efforts in every way. He felt compelled, however, not only to express his anger and to protest the work, but to actively oppose it in every way possible. In Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 7 and 8, you read, now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to close, that they became very angry, or their anger glowed warmly. And all of them conspired, or literally tied themselves together, to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. That is such a confusion, such a spirit, such a presence of mind that would hinder the work. That was their purpose. And the response of Nehemiah to this threat is legendary. It's in verse 9. Nehemiah says, nevertheless, we made our prayer to God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. Nehemiah answers their anger with prayer and vigilant watchfulness. And I want you to notice that combination, beloved. A faithful plea to God for his protection and a responsible effort to be ready to defend themselves in God's strength. So they just don't call upon the name of the Lord and then fall back and rest. But they call upon the name of the Lord, and then they anticipate that the Lord's going to equip them to the task of defending themselves, and so they prepare to do so. But as many of you know, the challenge to this work didn't just arise from without. In verse 10, Judah begins to complain. And Judah says, the strength, or that is the vigor of the laborers is failing or wavering like men whose legs are about to give out. We don't do this too much from hard labor anymore. It does happen sometimes, but think of yourself on a hike or on a run. And you know that point where your legs start to feel weak and get a little wobbly underneath of you? And that's what they're saying. Judah's saying, we're running out of strength and we're just becoming so weak that our legs are giving out. And there is so much rubbish that we're not able to build the wall. And our adversary said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they'll be upon us. Wherever you try to work, whatever you try to do, wherever you raise the army, wherever you come to protection, they'll attack. And they'll keep attacking. And they tell Nehemiah and the people that 10 times. They're attacking. John Trapp says, if God had not strengthened them, says one, it would have made them leave their work and run away. Not the threat from outside, but the threat from inside. Judah saying, oh, we're too tired, the work's too hard, there's too much rubble, and you know what? The enemy's just waiting to attack us and kill us. And just that complaint from within, says Trapp, was enough to make them run away if they did not have faith and they weren't strengthened by God. And again, Nehemiah's response to this complaint is both practical and it's filled with faith and it's gallant. It really is gallant. In Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 13, Nehemiah says, therefore, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked, and I arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. Nehemiah shored up the weak spots. He equipped the people to defend themselves. And then he challenged them all with a call to remember the power and glory of the Lord and to fight for their brethren and for their sons and for their daughters and for their wives and for their homes. Now today is obviously Father's Day. And Christians have different reactions to contrived occasions like this one. Some see them as a good opportunity to fulfill what is a biblical obligation to honor fathers. Others see it as nothing more than a contrivance, and usually adding that the Bible requires you to honor your father every day, and so why have a special day set aside to do that? And that's true, of course. The Bible does require that. A third group even goes a step further and objects to the occasion as an encroachment on the Lord's Day, pointing out that there's no warrant to the observance of such anniversaries in the church. The call of Scripture is for us as believers to defer to one another, especially in matters like this. Paul told the Romans in Romans chapter 14, who are you to judge another's servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. One person esteems one day above another. Another esteems every day alike. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. And that's all that's required, is you be convinced in your own mind. If you're putting your father before your God, that's wrong. And that needs to be corrected. If you're honoring your father under God, that's fine. And there's nothing wrong with that. But regardless of anyone's particular feelings on this general subject, it's difficult, I think, to object to a message on the challenges and the blessings of fatherhood at any time. It's really hard to do that. To say, well, we shouldn't have those ever. Nobody's going to say that. And as I think about the fathers and the grandfathers and even the great-grandfathers here today, I can't help but reflect on this passage. You and your families are under assault. The enemy, at the heart of all the opposition that there is to your efforts to raise your children in the fear and nurture and admonition of the Lord is far more furious and indignant against you and your families and your king than Sanballat was against Nehemiah. The ruler didn't like Nehemiah coming to the region, but Sanballat became particularly angry when he saw that Nehemiah was raising up the walls and creating a defense against the natural vulnerability that existed in Jerusalem at the time. When it became clear that he was creating a place to shut Sanballat and his followers out, a place of security and prosperity for Israel, a place from which they could even strike out against their enemies, Sanballat was incensed. And this is exactly what you fathers are doing in establishing Christian homes on the foundation of God's word. You're walling your wives and your children off from their enemy and equipping them to fight for themselves against him. And it causes the enemy to be incensed against you. You're an irritant by yourself. Now, just being a Christian, you're an irritant as a Christian. You are a menace to Satan as the leader of a home dedicated to serving Christ. Therefore, his anger burns white hot, and his indignation moves him to oppose you in every way possible. To attack, to undermine, to discourage, to hold you back in every effort, so that out of exhaustion and fear, he may bring you to that confusion and discouragement that at first hinders you, and then hopefully, from his perspective, brings you to such a place of frustration that being confounded, you stop trying. Peter warns, but few really listen. Be sober. Be vigilant. Because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And to no one is that message more important than to the father who's trying to establish a Christian home. You have an enemy who's going about like a roaring lion, seeking where and who he can devour. Remember how Nehemiah was opposed? He was called feeble, that is, sickly and weak. There has not been an age quite like this one, beloved, when every aspect of masculinity has been brought into question. Men are accused of being inept, ill-equipped, overly violent, inconsiderate, and not even essential to the establishment and good order of the family. Who are you? Who are you men trying to take the leadership of your home? Who are you? What are you feeble Christian fathers doing? What are you trying to do? Give it up. Sanballat mocked the attempt of the Jews to exercise any sort of freedom or independency. Who are you foolish fathers trying to build Christian homes and instill a sense of responsibility and independence in your children? What are you doing? Who do you think you are? Don't you know that their safety lies in the education, the protection, and the direction of the collective? Don't you know that? It's not you training them. It's all of us together as a village bringing about that end result. It's the collective that can do that. Who are you to be doing that? And to think that you can do it. And that you have the right to do it, even. The only way your children are going to grow up to be fully mature and secure and well-adjusted members of a global society is by the care and the concern of the collective. Every wise father today knows that he has to be very careful about how he deals with his children in public, because there are those in the collective who are ready not only to challenge him in what he says or does, but will be willing to report him to the authorities for any behavior considered unacceptable by any member of the collective. That's the world you're living in. I can remember correcting my children and having people come up afterwards and saying, "Oh, it's so good to see somebody correct their kids. Thank you for doing that." Today, fathers get reported to Health and Human Services for correcting their children in public, as if they're abusive. I'm not saying that there aren't abusive parents. There are. But a Christian father, a true Christian father, is not going to be among them. Sam Bout scorned their religious activities. You know, fathers, I'm sure that there are those who think that you should have no say in the spiritual education of your children. You realize that, right? There's an element in our society that thinks you should have no say in the spiritual education of your children. They not only deny the covenant and your duties to your children in it, but they oppose it. And if they had their way, and slowly they're getting that way, you would have little or nothing to say in the matter. Nehemiah's enemies questioned his actions in every way. And so it is for every Christian family. From the number of children you have, you and your wife have, should you be having all those children? To their education, should you really be teaching your children those things? To every aspect of your role as a father. What are you trying to do? Are you trying to revive those old-fashioned, long-abandoned, antiquated, and dangerous Christian values in your home? In your family? Is that what you're trying to do? In ancient times, Tertullian once reported that the pagans, because the Christians didn't have a God, they painted the image of their God for them. And they painted him with the head of a jackass with a Bible or a book in his hand. And when people said, "Why are you picturing our God that way?" they said, "Because that's you. And you are your God. And that's what you look like to us." And I'm sorry to say that in many cases, that's what we look like as Christian fathers. The enemy will use small things and great things, threats and innuendos, whatever serves his purpose from within and without. And he has an army of gullible minions to do his bidding and harassing, hindering, threatening, or discouraging you. Some knowingly, others ignorantly, and still others with a false sense of nobility or twisted morality. When Paul first wrote the Thessalonians, he wrote because he was concerned to know their spiritual welfare. And he said this to them in 1 Thessalonians 3:5. He says, "I'm writing lest by some means the tempter had tempted you and our labor might be in vain." He's writing to the whole church and saying, "I'm writing you because I know what Satan's capable of. And the tempter may have carried you all away and taken you away from the truth." The strength and safety of the church and of God's people are the grief and the vexation of its enemies. But it's not just the enemy from without that you have to contend with. There's opposition from within, within you and within those you love. Man is by nature a proud creature. But I believe that one of the ways that the Creator has employed to humble men is to place the man at a head, as the head of a family, and tasking him with the responsibility and all the accountability that comes with it. And if that's earnestly and faithfully undertaken, that man will invariably be brought to his knees before God. If he's honest, if he's earnest in his service of the King, he will invariably be brought to his knees before God as a father. Because of the very nature of the task, because of the responsibility of the task. It's a magnificent way of humbling the proud men. Nothing will reduce the man who thinks that he knows all things and who imagines that he's virtually omnipotent, that is able to do everything he intends, like being surrounded with a family. Suddenly you realize you don't know half what you thought you knew, and you can't do half of what you thought you could do because you thought you could do everything. And now you realize you can't do that. There are situations in which you can't have control. And there are things that you need to know that you just simply don't know. But it's also true that those that the father has to lead and to teach and to discipline within the family struggle with pride and all its ugly manifestations, as well as its fears and its uncertainties. And it may be that some of you feel like your dad is bucking the whole world in his efforts to create and maintain a Christian home. He and your mom are doing something too bothersome, and in the end, contrary to what a lot of other people are saying and doing. The Lord wants you to know, beloved, that he has placed a man of conviction and one endowed with courage at the head of your family. And I hope that rather than questioning him or doubting him, you'll pray for and support him in every way you can. But going back to you fathers, all these things, like the voices around Nehemiah say to you, why do it? Why work so hard? All around you, there are fathers who aren't trying to do that. All around you, there are fathers who have been willing to surrender and give up and let things go. Why not just give up and go with the flow? Give up the silly notion. Surrender to the collective before the collective strikes and takes it all away from you. Because you hear 10 times a day, that's what they want to do. They want to take it away from you. They want you no longer to be able to be the father you know you need to be. Do you really think you'll succeed? Is it really worth it? Do you really think that your worship and service of God is going to amount to anything? Do you really think that you can overcome the collective efforts of society and the devil in this work you're undertaking? Well, I would submit, my fellow fathers, the answer to all those questions, any doubts and all your fears or uncertainties should be exactly the same as Nehemiah's. And I pray that God would give you ears to hear his words. Don't be afraid of them. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. First of all, don't fear the enemy. That is, don't reverence the enemy. One of the hardest things for believers to do is to refrain from reverencing the enemy and his servants. And I want you to understand that there's a difference between a healthy respect and reverence. In Deuteronomy chapter 20 and verse 1, Moses said to the people of God, "When you go in the name of the Lord, when you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." Respect breeds caution and prudence, but reverence produces fear and intimidation. And you can see that Nehemiah didn't worship his enemies at all, in any way. And he calls on the men of Israel not to be afraid, or that is not to reverence them or worship those enemies. He wisely and prudently prepares to meet the threats, but he doesn't allow them to control what's going on out of fear. In fact, it's the way it's presented here, you can almost see it happening. Nehemiah saying, okay, they're blah, 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 blah. They're going to attack us. They're going to do all these things to us. Let's just work and be ready to fight when we need to. And that's his spirit in this. He doesn't second guess his resolves or his mission. He doesn't say, well, I wonder if I ought to be doing this. There's so much opposition. And look, they're not only complaining from my enemies, but even Judah's complaining. You know, I'm even getting complaints from within. And you know what? The work really is hard, and the people really are tired, and this really is a lot of labor. Why not just surrender? Maybe I've got the wrong calling here. Maybe I haven't heard the Lord correctly. Nehemiah doesn't even entertain any of those things. I already warned Dr. Stone about this, but a few nights ago, he and I were on a mission. We were driving along the shoreline on the East Coast, and the waves were high, and they were starting to mount up over the seawall and wash on to the road. And suddenly, a huge wave came rushing in. It towered over us, and it was obviously going to swamp the road and Dr. Stone's little convertible that we were in, but he kept on driving. And the wave came, and when it hit, we were buried in seawater. Couldn't see the road. It was up over our heads, actually, and we were struggling to get above to get our breath. But the doctor kept on driving. And I was certain the car was going to stall. But he pushed on, and we made our destination. And I remember thinking to myself in that dream, man, he didn't let the wave intimidate him. He just kept going. It was in the middle of a dream that all that happened, but it did. And I actually thought that. Now, dreams are silly, and they're often unexplainable things. The Christian life is no dream, and Christian fatherhood is certainly no drive along the beach. But it can't be properly carried out if you live in fear of the enemy, beloved. More fear of him than of God. John Trapp says that Nehemiah and his men were not more busy in building than the enemies active in deriding, conspiring, practicing to hinder and overthrow him. So yes, the enemy was very busy, but Nehemiah was busier doing what he was doing. It didn't frighten him. Instead, it strengthened their resolve, it hardened their nerves, and it made them even more active in the work they had to do. In Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 19, we read, "The Lord by wisdom founded the earth, by understanding he established the heavens. By his knowledge the depths were broken up, and clouds dropped down the dew. My son, let them not depart from your eyes. Keep sound wisdom and discretion, so they will be life to your soul and grace to your neck. Then you will walk safely in your way, and your foot will not stumble. When you lie down, you will not be afraid. Yes, you will lie down, and your sleep will be sweet. Do not be afraid of sudden terror, nor of trouble from the wicked when it comes. For the Lord will be your confidence, and will keep your foot from being caught." Don't fear your enemies. Secondly, Nehemiah says, remember the Lord, great and awesome. The best antidote to fear is faith. Matthew Henry said, the reigning fear of God is the best antidote against the ensnaring fear of man. The God you men serve is Jehovah, the great I am. He can do all his holy will. And when he does, there is no one, not even Satan himself, who can stay his hand or safely challenge him. McLaren said, if we can grasp God, we shall not dread Sanballat and his crew. Unless we do, the world is full of dangers, which is not folly to fear. Nehemiah says he is great. God is power, holiness, wisdom, justice, love, all twisted together. In Psalm 96, we read, the Lord is great and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the peoples are idols, but God, the Lord, made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. Give to the Lord, O families of the people, give to the Lord glory and strength. Nehemiah then adds that your God is awesome. And what he means here plays off of what he commanded at first. Don't be afraid of your enemies. Be afraid, he says, of the fearsome one. That's literally what he says here. Don't you be afraid of your enemies. You be afraid of the fearsome one, your God. And he doesn't mean fear in the sense of dread, but in the sense of true reverence. This is the one you serve under, the great and fearsome one. He recruited you as a father. He will equip you. He promises to do so. And he will help you for Christ's sake, for his own son's sake. You can't have a better captain, says Matthew Henry, than your God. Isaiah 41, he says, fear not, I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Behold, all those who are incensed against you shall be ashamed and disgraced. They shall be as nothing. And those who strive with you shall perish. You shall seek them and not find them. Those who contend with you, those who war against you, shall be as nothing, as a non-existent thing. For I, the Lord your God, will hold your right hand, saying to you, fear not, I will help you. Now this doesn't mean that there won't be challenges. Faith is exercised by those challenges. Faith exercised is faith strengthened. And because you're determined to do this, and because God has promised to be by your side, that doesn't mean you won't have to face what may at sometimes be unbelievable challenges to what you're trying to do. But the truth is that the Lord will not leave you alone in that struggle. He will not leave you to yourself. But he'll give you that grace and that strength which you need as you rest and rely on him. Peter said, who is he that will harm you if you become followers of what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. And do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. And then what's the third thing that Nehemiah says to do? He says, don't worship your enemies. Worship God and fight. 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 From the beginning, Nehemiah showed his intention to fight. And you know what that did? Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem got together and they said, you know what we'll do? We'll sneak up on them where they won't be expecting it, and we'll surprise attack them and bring all this down to nothing. That was their boast. But you know why that strategy could not work? Because Nehemiah made it known that he intended to fight. And if somebody says, we're going to sneak up on him and attack him, but that person says, you know what, I'm ready to fight anytime, any place, anywhere. How's that strategy going to work? Can you sneak up on the person who says, I'm going to be ready to fight anytime, anywhere, any place? All the time, I'm going to be looking out for a fight, and when I see a fight coming, I'm going to meet it with a battle in return. How can you sneak up on that person and attack them? You can't. So Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem had to give up that whole strategy because they couldn't succeed. They knew they couldn't because Nehemiah was ready to fight at every turn. That strategy becomes useless when the leader of the people and the people themselves are always ready. And the Father, who's always ready, will still be challenged, but less surprised and more prepared when the challenge comes. Doesn't mean the enemy still won't come. He will. But you'll be less surprised and more prepared if you're always ready to fight. Matthew Henry says, remember, all that is dear to you in your world lies at stake. He says, that's what Nehemiah was saying to these soldiers. Everything that is dear to you in the world lies at stake. Therefore, behave yourselves valiantly. And that's true for you men too. Everything that is dear to you in the world is at stake here. William of Orange was leading the Dutch army against the Spaniards who were trying to overtake them. And the Spaniards were winning the day, and they had driven the Dutch and William of Orange into a very small area of the Netherlands. And William of Orange knew there was only one way out, and that was to fight. And so he addressed all of his soldiers, and he said to them, "Over here are the Spaniards. Over there is the sea. You either have to drink that sea or battle those Spaniards and win. Those are your only two alternatives." And what he meant by that was, you either have to fight your way clear or drown. Those are the only two alternatives. And gentlemen, those are the only two alternatives in your world too. You either have to fight and be valiant, or you and your family will drown. McLaren says, "Family love is God's best of earthly gifts. And though it is sometimes duty to forget your own people and your father's house, nothing short of these highest obligations can supersede the sweet one of straining every nerve for the well-being of dear ones in the hallowed circle of home." Isaiah, telling his people of the Lord's word, says this in Isaiah 51. And it's a message to every Christian father here. "Lift up your eyes to the heavens and look on the earth beneath. For the heavens will vanish away like smoke. The earth will grow old like a garment. And those who dwell in it will die in like manner. But my salvation will be forever, and my righteousness will not be abolished. Listen to me, you who know righteousness, you people in whose heart is my law. Do not fear the reproach of men, nor be afraid of their insults. For the moth will eat them up like a garment, and the worm will eat them like wool. But my righteousness will be forever, and my salvation from generation to generation. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the ancient days and the generations of old. Are you not the arm that cut Rahab apart and wounded the serpent? Are you not the one who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, that made the depths of the sea a road for the redeemed to cross over? So the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, with everlasting joy on their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness. Sorrow and sighing shall flee away. I, even I, am he who comforts you. Who are you that you should be afraid of a man who will die, and of the Son of Man who will be made like grass? And you forget the Lord your Maker, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth. You have feared continually every day because of the fury of the oppressor, when he was prepared to destroy. And where is the fury of the oppressor? The captive exile hastens, that he may be loosed, that he should not die in the pit, and that his bread should not fail. But I am the Lord your God, who divided the sea, whose waves roared. The Lord of hosts is his name." There are all kinds of threats around us. But men, our God has been blessing Christian fathers from the beginning. From the beginning. And he continues to do so. Do not fear your enemies. Trust in your God and fight. Let's pray.